Who, me, what, already? Crap. All right, well, I got everything on. Oh, I need Fox News on here. Morning, everybody. Unless you're in the East, then it's afternoon. Unless you're in Europe, then it's evening. Unless you're in Asia, then it's morning again. Right? Pretty early. All right, so let's see. That's the wrong channel. Gotta have my Fox News on during the show so I know what's not right. So I know what it is I'm supposed to tell you to be terrified about. Oh, it's terrifying. One America News. I want to watch them more. They seem like, you know, they're trying to be the new upstart cable news channel, and yet they're nothing but Republican-type clones. It seems like you could try to mix it up a little bit. Anyway. Do you guys have that one? All right, so there's Fox. They're talking about snow. If anything really bad happens, let me know, because they're not going to cover it in a timely fashion, I don't think. Not that I'm counting on. Anyway, not good. Not yet. All right. Hey, it's my show. Today on the show, we've got, I better figure out this guy's name. Gabriel Matthew. He is a lawyer for Omar Khadr. And he's going to be on at 1 o'clock. Eastern time, that is. And also Adam Morrow, our friend Adam Morrow, reporter living in Cairo, Egypt, is going to be on to talk about some of the badness. Oh, man, I forgot to turn the heater off again. I'll try to remember. At the break, you know. Adam, he's going to get us caught up on what's going on in Egypt. Which I'm way behind on, but I know one communist young female was killed. They were shooting at him with birdshot. She died of it anyway. I mean, it was less than lethal means, yeah, lethal. You know, depending. They say it was a young leftist. I don't know, but there's protests going on in Tahrir Square and all of that for the anniversary of the Arab Spring. What a tragedy, man. Anyway, so Adam Morrow is going to be on to talk about that. And Omar Khadr. There's a Free Khadr Now campaign, which is just great because that guy doesn't belong in prison. And even if he ever belonged in prison, which he never really deserved to be in prison at all, boy, has he done his time. He's done his time before they ever kidnapped him out of Afghanistan. He was done doing his time when he was still locked in the Bagram torture dungeon. But anyway, so we're going to find out all about Omar Khadr. In fact, at libertystickers.com, you can get a bumper sticker with Omar Khadr on it. It has a picture of him at 15, and it says, "Your government tortured this kid." Because, you know, I know conservatives like bragging about stuff like that, and so I thought, you know, maybe you can brag about it. All right, I got a ton of news. I got a WikiLeaks thing to talk about here. Did you see somebody crashed a drone at the White House? I wonder if the Secret Service is competent enough to track the drone down through its serial number, et cetera, and figure out whose drone it was. And then I wonder what's going to happen to whoever. They better accidentally crashed a drone on the White House lawn. But just think about that, man. Boy, it's a brave new world, huh? And I wonder what Obama thinks of that. What? A drone? Here at the White House? No. That's the headquarters of where we fly drones around at people. The chickens are forbidden from coming home to roost. But, where'd all this technology come from in the first place? The state subsidized it all. As a matter of time anyway, I guess. But that's why there's drones everywhere. And so, now already at the White House. Somebody crashed a drone. Very interesting. Don't know anything else about it. And I did see one report where they changed their mind and denied that it was a drone. No, it wasn't a drone. We thought it was, but it wasn't. But then the other thing said, yeah, it was. It was a quadricopter. So, I don't know. It's amazing to me those things stay upright. I guess if you have a microchip in there. Yeah, it's fast enough at computing things. Pretty fancy technology, man. All right, and then, yeah, I got plenty of news, and I got cops to complain about. You know what I really want to start off the show with for the last couple of few minutes? Because I don't want to go on for a whole segment about this today. I'll try to spare you. But all over Twitter this morning, oh, I know what it was. Somebody sent me a link to something at the Daily Caller. And then there, all over the Daily Caller page, was all of this stuff about Islam. What does it take to get the Tucker Carlson guys to love Bill Maher? Well, they all hate Muslims together, so there are a bunch of links and videos all about Bill Maher, and there's links all over the place about this person accuses that person of being in denial about the role of radical Islam in this and that and the other thing. And I'm here to say to you, it's a tragedy, man. It is just, to me, the saddest part of it is the lack of intellect being betrayed here. Are you kidding me? We've been at this for 14 years now. And here's what hasn't happened in 14 years. 1 billion Muslims going to war with the West. That hasn't happened. There are millions of Muslims in America. Maybe as many as 5 or 6 million Muslims in America right now. Now, if you really believed that their religion mandates that they go to war with all people who don't believe in their religion, how come your city ain't on fire right now? How come they all got up this morning and had breakfast and sent their kids to school and went to work just like you? Oh, because I get it. It must be because they are all hypocrites. They're all secret atheists who don't really believe in their religion. But if they did, then they would kill us all. Is that right? I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like they would win. If there was really a war in America, 6 million out of 300 million. But you've noticed, right? You've noticed in the last 14 years, it's occurred to you at least a couple of times that, wow, I'm living in a country with millions of Muslims, and they're not trying to kill me. Here I've got a gun, and yet I haven't had to shoot a single Muslim yet because they're not trying to kill me. You've noticed that, right? There are more than 1 billion Muslims in the world. Some say now as many as 1.25 billion Muslims in the world. And they live predominantly from Morocco to the Philippines. Well, through Indonesia, I don't know, predominantly. But there are majorities, excluding India, from Morocco to the Philippines. There are more than 1 billion of them in the world. And yet, well, excluding every last Islamic State fighter on the ground in Iraq. If you want to talk about actual international terrorists who would even consider trying to attack America or our Western allies, you're talking about hundreds of guys. Hundreds. Even now. Hundreds. Hundreds. You know, Phil Giraldi comes on the show every year to talk about the State Department terrorist report. Because every year, the State Department puts out a terrorist report where they tell the truth. And they say, well, we got a couple thousand here and a couple thousand there, but yeah, they're pretty much concerned with their parochial kind of disputes. And how many actual international terrorists are there who would come to the United States and attack us? Maybe hundreds, if they could get here. So, how many radical Muslims are there in the world? Certainly millions. If you're talking about they have severe right-wing beliefs and they're not conservatives about it, they want radical revolutionary change toward those right-wing, you know, back-in-time reactionary type extremist sort of beliefs, like, say, Bin Laden and people who see the world his way. And yet, they're not all attacking us either. It's actually only a tiny percentage of those who would ever even try to fight in a civil war against the Shia of Iraq, against the Shia of Syria, for the Islamic State. So, you can see right there that all this crap about Islam is just a bunch of propaganda. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Now, you know, I know Fox News is for old people, but I don't know. I hope I don't become stupid when I'm old just because I'm old. And as I was sitting here debunking the propaganda right there in the last segment on Fox News, that's what they were talking about. I looked up at the TV as we were going out to break, and that's what they were talking about was Obama says we're at war with Al-Qaeda, not radical Islam. Oh, my God. Can you imagine if that was what George Bush had said after September 11th? Instead of declaring a war on terror, he had declared a war on Al-Qaeda. It would have been over by Christmas 2001. Ladies and gentlemen, boy, did they get away with one hell of an attack here. But the sad truth is there's probably only a couple of hundred guys to kill over this. But don't worry, we're going to blow the crap out of them. And then, but, you know, there's only a couple of hundred of them. And then that'll be it. That'll be it. Paul Wolfowitz has given us great advice. We need to get all of our bases out of Saudi Arabia. We're ignoring the part where he says we should move them all into Iraq. What, are you crazy? But we are going to get them out of Saudi Arabia because that's what got us into this mess. Good point, Paul. And then that would have been it. And the war would have been over. And now Obama, who has spread Al-Qaeda throughout the world like dandelion seeds, like AIDS, like full-blown AIDS throughout Africa, throughout the Middle East. Now he wants to narrow the war down to Al-Qaeda, too. Well, does that include the Islamic State? By all means, just forget it. Don't fight the Islamic State either. Who knows with these kooks? But meanwhile, here's back to my point about what idiots Fox News viewers have got to be. The expert guest is saying, yeah, they just won't admit the role of Islam, the role of Islam. Okay, well, what is it then? Admit it then, Mr. Fox News expert. Talk to me, man. I'm waiting. No, he doesn't ever explain. He doesn't say Islam is evil and Islam mandates war against good people. Islam mandates war against the whites. Islam mandates war against Christians. Islam mandates that they kill, kill, kill because blood makes the grass grow. He doesn't even say. Never mind a quotation, right? He doesn't even say what it is he's accusing Islam of doing here. He's just leaving it for your idiot father, and I'm saying this because the demographics are that people in their 60s and 70s are the ones watching Fox. Them and me are the ones watching Fox. Old white Republicans and me are the ones watching Fox. And so your dad and your granddad sitting there watching are not supposed to wonder? Well, huh, that's funny because I've been alive all this time and yet apparently Islamic terrorism has only been an American problem for the last 15 years. Right, because it's not like they're going to go back and tell the whole story about how Clinton got us into this mess with these guys, right? Clinton and Bush before him. So as far as they know, history began on September 11th. But they don't wonder? I guess they don't wonder. That's funny. I could swear I remember George H.W. Bush having a war over there, right? And then didn't Bill Clinton have a blockade and starve a million people to death in Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia, the Holy Peninsula, land of Mecca and Medina? Huh. And that is what Islam has to do with it. Solidarity. It's just like if I told your dad, hey, the Israelis massacred some Arabs. And your dad would assume Muslims and go, yeah, kill them all, right? And then, but what if I said they were Arab Christians? Then your dad might go, okay, yeah, kill them all because they were Arabs, you said, right? But that pause there, that consideration that maybe they're a tiny bit human if they have the same religion as your dad. Or your father-in-law, whichever is the right-wing, warmongering, bigot, racist, Fox News-watching idiot in your family. It could be your little brother. I don't know.
That solidarity, that sameness, that's what counts. That's the point. That's what makes a French Muslim identify with an Iraqi Muslim who's, hey, that guy's like me. Huh. Again, this isn't a rationalization. It's just an explanation of what's really going on here. It's just like if you asked a bunch of Texans about New Yorkers in the year 2000, New York is like a foreign country. You know, when the first World Trade Center got bombed and six people were killed, Texans didn't care. People west of the Rocky Mountains, they didn't care. That was worth one shrug, one raised eyebrow. They promptly forgot about it. New York might as well be in Canada. But then a severe enough attack happens, 3,000 people are killed, and all of a sudden you've got Americans who've never even been to New York, who couldn't find New York on a map, who are saying, I'm on Team USA against the bad guys. Line up, salute, show me who to kill. Right? Same thing. Same thing. So that's what Islam has to do with it. Solidarity. Who's us and who's them? Who's on this side? Who's on that side? It's just like when you read about the Sunni-Shia civil war that George W. Bush started over there. All the time you can read about how it's this epoch-long, eons-long, unending religious war between Sunni and Shia. That is such a damned lie. It is a sectarian war between Sunni and Shia, but they're not fighting over who's a blasphemer or not. Well, I guess sort of kind of the Islamic State is now after we've, you know, completely put them through the burner over there for the past decade. But what they're fighting about is who is who. Who is loyal to which faction, right? It's like in this new sniper movie, they have the Al-Qaeda sniper working for Muqtada al-Sadr in Sadr City. Oh, for crying out loud. Yeah, don't even bother who's who or what they're fighting about. But I'll tell you, when Al-Qaeda and the Sadrists were fighting against each other, they weren't fighting over you don't believe the same as me. They were fighting over who was going to rule this street, this neighborhood, this city. From here on, that's what they were fighting about. Power, oil, money, power. And the difference between Sunni Shia was the difference between who's on whose side. It doesn't mean they're mandated by their religion to fight any more than you're mandated by Christianity to fight. Or, you know, Californians are mandated by Buddhism to fight. They fight out of a sense of defense. Defense of others, even. How difficult is that? It's really easy if you're not a liar or if you're not, you know, already geared toward just accepting what liars tell you. Oh, Obama won't admit the role of Islam. Well, you know what? If you had the slightest explanation for what you were even claiming the role of Islam is, I guess you'd have a stupid wrong point. But you know what? Gallup poll did a survey, and they wrote a book about it. It's called What Muslims Really Think, and it came out in 2009. It's called What Muslims Really Think, and they surveyed Muslims from Morocco to the Philippines. And you know what they really think? They like America. They like the West. They like freedom. They like technology. They just don't like our foreign policy. And even still, its tiniest percentage support any kind of terrorist strikes against us. Read the book yourself. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. You know, I saw a thing where Bill Kristol was denouncing Jeb Bush. I wonder what's behind that. I wonder if Jeb Bush ever had, like, some kind of harsh word for Kristol, and so maybe now they don't like each other. Wouldn't that be interesting? I wonder if they're just playing.
I still have all my money on, which I don't have any money, but I have all my money on Jeb Bush for 2016. He's got all the power factions locked up. Who can oppose him? Not Romney. Republicans won't turn out for Romney. We've seen it twice now. They just won't. Because they're bigots. And to them, a Mormon might as well be a Muslim. And so they just won't support him. And nobody else has the money or the connections. So the race is already over. You can forget about it. And Hillary, yes, she's got the money and the connections, but her negatives are just too high, man. Too many people just don't like her and never will. Like you and me, for example. She's just a horrible person. She's so ambitious. She's worse than Rand Paul. She just wears her ambition all over her sleeve. It's all about her to her, and everyone can tell that. Whereas Jeb kind of can pretend that he's a nice guy, pass the beer test with you, and all that kind of crap that people love. So anyway, you heard it here first 3 or 4 years ago when I first told you 3 or 4 years ago it's going to be Jeb. All right, anyway. So, man, I read this thing in The Guardian. Is this it? No, this isn't it. Davos, Switzerland. This isn't it. Oh, I got to get to the Syria thing. All right, well, I can't find the link, but it doesn't matter. I read this thing in The Guardian, and it was about income inequality and the discussion going on at Davos. Now, Davos is sort of like where all the most zillionaire-ish, most powerful politicians and financiers and zillionaires in the world all meet in Switzerland to talk about what to do with the rest of us, basically. It's your evil secret conspiracy theory, only it's all aired on C-SPAN. It's perfectly open and above board and very interesting. And, you know, yeah, they all try to pretend. And it's a contest to see who can sound the most public-spirited and that kind of crap. But so what one of the guys was saying there, I didn't keep track of who, but it was somebody, you know, some prominent, super-rich zillionaire said, you know, hedge fund managers and zillionaires all over the world are buying farmland with and building airstrips in isolated places, in the most isolated places. And he cited, I guess, in the quote that I read, New Zealand, for example, because they're preparing for the world to fall apart and they think that they're going to have to bug out. And they're looking at Ferguson and saying that Ferguson is, you know, a mark on the thermometer of this. And they didn't say, what about Ferguson? But what they mean is, well, they did, I guess. They're talking about the reaction and the kind of grassroots organization. And basically they're gloating and saying, look, basically poor people with real jobs or no job, they can't really create sustainable organizations that really can create a powerful voice and maintain it in order to challenge our power. Just like the old Trilateral Commission report from the 1970s. The crisis of democracy. The crisis of democracy is that there could be a little bit, meaning, you know, regular people actually exercising power through the forms of the constitutional government of America. Holy crap, how can we prevent this from happening? You know? And so this is their biggest fear. That regular people who don't have their own Smitherses to follow them around and carry out their orders all day will somehow, you know, maybe through Facebook or something, figure out how to really organize themselves and have a powerful voice and challenge the kind of things that we do to them. And so what does that mean? That means that the cops that they have armed with all this military equipment and have trained to act with total brutality, and the courts that are run by them that sustain all this and give them complete immunity and impunity to mistreat Americans however they feel like, that this is creating a backlash. When people are poor, people are desperate, and then the cops kill their sons, hey, they might riot. They might actually figure out who in town's house to burn down. And we're afraid that that might happen, that the people who are exercising all the power here or are refusing to intervene when others with the power are beating everyone else over the head and they have the power to intervene, but they spend all the time on their yacht or whatever, that people might get pissed off at them. And so then they're going to have to run and just leave us all to burn. And so, wow, really? This is what they're talking about openly on microphones at Davos. This is America. This isn't just the world. This is the developed Western industrialized world through the eyes of the super rich that, like, well, crap. Maybe we all ought to flee to Galt's Gulch and just let America burn to the ground. Except who's burning it to the ground? They're not taking all their cops with them. They're going to leave all the cops and soldiers here. They're going to turn America into police state. They expect nothing but protests and riots and fires from here on. And why? Because they have ruined America. It wasn't poor, powerless black people that ruined America. It was rich, white, and Jewish billionaires who ruined America. They're the ones who have all the power. They're the ones who own the banks, the military-industrial complex firms, the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the agribusiness companies. They're the fascists. They're the ones who run our quasi-free market from Washington, D.C., and they're the ones who have hollowed this country out like mobsters, you know, like in Goodfellas, right? Where they take over the guy's restaurant, they hollow out everything, they run up all the tabs on credit, resell everything, take everything they can get, and then burn it to the ground. And then they want to cry that, oh my God, we're afraid that the American people might even get the slightest clue as to who their enemy is. And I'm a libertarian. My problem is not wealth. My problem is power. And what's funny is these guys are quoted in the same Guardian article, you know, disdaining the politicians. Look at how the politicians are ruining the country. Yeah, well, what are you doing about it? Show me billionaires who actually are pushing for anything but this. I mean, you could say the Coke industries lean a little bit more pro-peace, but that's just because their oil interests are in Venezuela, not in the Middle East. They might be the new guys on the block, and yes, they fund some of our friends and guests on the show, and they've supported libertarian causes for a long time. Many of them in a very self-interested kind of way. Others of them in an ideological kind of way. But, in fact, the Kochs are a rare example of billionaires who even care enough to say, like, hey, we should do some drug war reform and criminal justice reform and this kind of thing. And the Democrats and liberals are right to scream their heads off about the Kochs because they are oligarchs. They are not libertarians. They are conservative Republican Party types, and they are on welfare. Now, they're not bankers. They actually do produce things and sell them for a living, and so that's good. But they also are perfectly happy to hire the government to gangsterize people right out of their land to build a pipeline across it or anything like that. They're not the best of men, but just take them by comparison with the rest of the oligarchs who would rather just buy farmland in New Zealand and run away and be perfectly happy to sit back and watch Lockheed run the Democratic Party for you, to watch Israel run the Democratic Party for you, when all they have to do is spend a measly $1 billion on a campaign to say, hey, the Israelis have way too much influence in Washington, D.C. Run a campaign to say, hey, let's acknowledge the influence of Lockheed and General Dynamics and SIAC and Northrop Grumman, and let's spend $1 billion of my personal fortune spotlighting which politicians are on the payroll of the merchants of death. Which politicians do what Benjamin Netanyahu, the blood-soaked killer, want just because he wants it and because that's where they get their money? No, they rather just get on their Learjet and run. As well, perhaps they should. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right. Hey, thanks for asking, Chris, because I finally went and Googled it. As inequality soars, the nervous super rich are already planning their escapes. You know what? My brother-in-law got me a Onion t-shirt from 98 because it's got a Lewinsky story on it. It's an Onion, Our Dumb Century from 1998, and it's super rich, top 1%, long before the 99% thing was a meme, right? Top 1% complete construction of private escape pod. I have that shirt. It's in my closet, buried somewhere in the garage or something. 1% complete construction of private escape pod. Here we go. As inequality soars, the nervous super rich are already planning their escapes. Back to that in 1 second. I got to tell you two things. Go read Philip Weiss today. Well, read Philip Weiss every day. But if you go to antiwar.com, he's the spotlight. And it's all about the reaction to the Dermer Netanyahu Boehner plot to bring Netanyahu to Washington to give a speech denouncing Obama's negotiations with Iran. And it's turning into a huge kind of thing in Washington, D.C. It's really important. And Phil Weiss basically has a rundown of media outrage in places where you might not expect it. You might be pleasantly surprised to see it. So please go take a look at that. It's a spotlight on antiwar.com today. And then also you should know that Bashar al-Assad is interviewed in Foreign Affairs. And I called Garrett this morning, and he hadn't seen it yet. And he wanted more time before coming on the show to comment after reading this thing. So I'll have Gareth on the show tomorrow for you. But Gareth actually wrote an article that I didn't interview him about, if you can believe that. And now would be a good time to catch up. And the article was about small ceasefires leading to bigger ones and a possible negotiated end to the Syrian war. And just so anybody isn't confused, I'm against Bashar al-Assad. And in fact, I don't believe that he has a right to live any more than a robber crawling in your window in the middle of the night continues to have a right to live. He has forfeited it. He's a tyrant and a fascist and a bastard. But that doesn't mean it's justified for America or its allies to back a bunch of bin Ladenites against him for the last 4 years, which is basically what they've done, as we've covered on the show for the last 4 years. And I'm not on this guy's side, but I would say it's telling that he hasn't lost yet, when he is nothing but a totalitarian fascist monster, and yet somehow he has all this support, and that's because of who his enemies are, as you might imagine. So that's at Foreign Affairs, and they won't make you sign in any paywall or anything. Doesn't look like it's or maybe if it does try to do that, use a different browser, but then go through Google News first. And then it'll work for you. Assad interviewed in Foreign Affairs. Okay, so now here's the thing. Back to the whole super rich versus everybody else thing. The enemy is the state. And they quote some billionaire in here saying, yeah, it's these politicians, man. All they care about is where the money is coming from. They have no respect for the national interest whatsoever. The system's completely corrupt. All the interests being kept in mind are the most short-term interests. And it's funny because you even hear sort of like a socialist, anti-capitalist mentality from these guys saying that, geez, our current system is what's gotten into this mess. Yeah, well, you're damn right about that. But here's my thing about that. First of all, any person would have to be a madman to want capital to be held in public hands, meaning state hands. World tried communism, it starved everybody to death, and then it all fell apart. And so we all know better than that. You must, absolutely must have private ownership of capital under whatever corporate or private arrangements or whatever the hell. The problem is in the cronyism. And agribusiness aside, big pharma fascism aside, the military-industrial complex aside, other than abolishing the entire Congress, presidency, Supreme Court, and starting over from scratch, you can boil all of this evil down to the monetary policy of America's central bank, the Federal Reserve System. And there's only one solution to the crisis, and that is sound money. This is what's, you can go back and read, and I'm not a master of all the statistics, but you can see different stats saying, you know, people's real standard of living may have increased some, but not much since the year 2000, overall averaged out. And if you look at real wages, they'll say it's been since 1990, since the average guy had an upshot in real wages. And you see this kind of self-criticism at Davos where these guys are going, Jesus, we are just running off to the bank with everything here. And now the Oxfam numbers are always way overblown. But yes, it is true that the very smallest percentage of the human population on Earth controls the vast majority of the capital. And the ways that they use it mostly are for evil. Mostly what they do is they turn right to the dark side of force, that is state power, and it's pennies on the dollar. Think about it. If you have $1 billion, how easy it is to bribe congressmen with a few thousand dollars worth of steak dinners, cocaine and whores and whatever, and then they do whatever you want. Reach right in the treasury and hand you more billions and billions and billions. It's the biggest honeypot in the history of the world. It's an equation for bankruptcy, and there's really no stopping it unless you have sound money, which just puts the brakes on it all. They just can't spend beyond what they can tax you without the pitchforks and torches coming out unless they can print the money. And so take away their ability to print the money. And then here's the other thing, and this is the most important thing. And I'm sorry, I know I'm talking about banking and it sounds boring, but wait, this is the really exciting part, man. You know how the economy, and I'm sorry, libertarians, I know you already know this, everyone else, you know how sometimes the economy's doing pretty good, and then, oh man, all of a sudden it's terrible again. And of course, you notice there's huge banker bailouts going on in the background, but just in your neighborhood, in your business that you're, you know, work for or are trying to get away with owning and prospering in, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, and it keeps going up and down. Well, we all know about, you know, I don't know, say, a harsh winter comes to Florida and kills all the oranges and drives up the price of juice, right? Okay, there's no accounting for that, there's easy account for that. Simple supply-demand. Supply got tight, demand was still high, hey, prices had to increase. Simple, right? But what causes an entire economy to go through really high prices and then low ones and then a bunch of new startup businesses, and then a bunch of crashes? If you listen to your government school teachers, it's the business cycle. It's what capitalism does to us. Except, wait a minute. According to them, it's what capitalism doesn't do to us, because capitalism used to do that to us, but then the government solved the problem by taking over the economy in the 1930s. Remember that? Hardy har har. Well, it's been nothing but boom and bust since then. And why? It's because the government actually had a central bank for 20 years preceding the crash of 29 and the Great Depression, the Federal Reserve Bank. And what they did was they inflated the money supply to pay for the First World War. And then they inflated it more throughout the 20s to prevent the consequences of the First World War from coming due, not only to the Americans, but to our allies in Europe too. And then finally, it all came due. Finally, it all came crashing down, and everybody's prices had to go back to reality as determined by subjective actors in a marketplace. Crash. It's the government central bank that causes the boom, that causes the bust. It's Ludwig. See, I said it wrong my whole life, but now I got to get it right. It's Ludwig von Mises. He figured all this out, and he put it all down. It's called The Theory of Money and Credit. And he wrote it, what's the year? He wrote it 95 years ago. No, wait a minute. Might have been before that. I think it was 95 years ago. And then anyway, one of his students, Friedrich Hayek, you might have heard of him, he won the Nobel Prize for this too. It's called The Austrian Theory of the Business Cycle. And and it sounds simple and easy, and it is really, but it's also completely ignored. It's absolutely the minority report about how the economy works. It's not just, you know, your neighbor who never heard of, you know, never studied economics at all, who to him it seems like everything's okay, and then all of a sudden it gets bad. Okay seems like it's the standard. It should be the standard is okay. And then all of a sudden the economy gets bad. Why? Well, because okay is actually artificially okay. Real okay is down here a bit. But we go through an artificial boom, and it's only the Austrians who say that the correction is the crash is the necessary correction to an artificial high. The rest of consensus economics, and certainly in politics, is that whenever we're in an artificial boom, that's like your completely nice but ignorant neighbor thinks regular times. And then the crash comes because, man, we just didn't have enough regulations. And down this pit we climb. But if you want to know, it's the Austrian theory of the business cycle. So go read about it. Oops. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I screwed up, and I don't know if I got my time zone wrong or if I just got my name wrong or what the hell, but I don't know. Oh, I know what I'll do. I'm going to try to figure it out. That's what I'm going to do. First, I got to figure out what kind of audio to pipe in for you. I was listening to music. I should have had my soundbite player open instead of my music one. Hey, it's live radio. I can screw up all I want. You know, I stopped by my Facebook page accidentally just because on my other computer it was still in the saved things, which I quit Facebook like a year ago. And two or three of the comments that people had left were, man, you suck at interviewing people. Your questions are way too long. What's the matter with you? And I thought, yeah, I know. But see, here's the thing about it. That's the point of the show. It sucks. But you don't mind. You're supposed to not mind because I'm good on everything, even if I suck at everything. You see how that works? All right, here.
The point, very simple, was this. We knew the Soviets were already conducting operations in Afghanistan. We knew there was opposition in Afghanistan to the progressive effort which was being made by the Soviets to take over. And we felt, therefore, it made a lot of sense to support those who were resisting. And we decided to do that. This, of course, probably convinced the Soviets even more to do what they were planning to do, which was to try to make a general takeover of the country by force of arms, and got them embroiled in an adventure which proved disastrous for them.
In the same interview, you were asked whether you regretted having supported Islamic fundamentalists and having armed future terrorists. Your reply was, what is more important in the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the end of the Cold War? Do you still stand by this statement?
It sounds like a very free translation of a comment regarding the importance of the Taliban. The Taliban itself wasn't very important. What was important was the fact that the Soviets pulverized Afghanistan, really destroyed it and polarized it, and subsequently produced the circumstances which are still confronting us in Afghanistan and that part of the world. But the fact that the Soviets became involved in an adventure which they could not win was positive from the standpoint of the West. Don't forget, the Soviets were busy training terrorists all over the place in the 80s. They had camps all over the Soviet Union for terrorist activity. Can you imagine what the world would be like today if there was still a Soviet Union? So yes, compared to the Soviet Union and to its collapse, the Taliban were unimportant.
All right. Finally finished that answer. Jesus. All right. Sorry for the delay, folks. Screw up on my part here. No problem, though. Got it all straightened out. Did you notice the Tom Dispatch piece on antiwar.com today? It was, it's still at tomdispatch.com, and we're running it under Tom's name today at antiwar.com. And it's called Bringing the Battlefield to the Border, or Gaza in Arizona, How Israeli High-Tech Firms Will Up-Armor the U.S.-Mexican Border. My God. It's by Todd Miller and Gabriel M. Chavone. And I got Gabriel on the line here. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. I'm fine. Thank you.
Good. Very happy to have you here. It says here you're a writer from Tucson, and you blog at the Electronic Intifada. Very good. Okay, so what a nightmare. I guess, first of all,
The article tends to really focus on Arizona. Is that because they're kind of ahead of the curve on hiring Israelis to teach them how to build separation barriers?
Mm-hmm. In the cases here in southern Arizona, yes, that's correct. And in the case of the federal government, it's long been a focus of U.S. border enforcement and immigration strategy, and really since Clinton.
And now, are you metal detecting on a beach right now somewhere?
No, I'm actually in a building at the University of Arizona that won't interfere too much.
No, it's all right. I'm just kind of playing around. okay, so I guess go ahead and start the story where you started here. I won't even try to say the guy's first name right because it's too many vowels in a row for me. IDF General came and gave a PowerPoint to these guys explaining, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, imagine the scene. You're in a big arena, you know, where you expect to have sports events happening and lots of cheering. And that day, there was a lot of cheering, but from different people and in a different way. And there were lots of border police folks in their uniforms. There were corporate executives in their suits. And this Israeli Brigadier General is, I mean, he says, he clicks on screen, like you said, his PowerPoint presentation showing the enclosure wall in Gaza that the United States is paying for and that Israel maintains. And he says, we have learned a lot from Gaza. It's a great laboratory. And he was surrounded by all sorts of high-tech gadgets and the latest border policing technology. There were things like surveillance balloons with high-powered cameras floating over. There were desert camouflaged armored vehicle made by Lockheed Martin, the largest military defense company in the world. There were seismic sensor systems that detect the movement of people and all the other wonders of modern border policing. But this wasn't a scene, like, as we say, sketched out by some top dystopian writer like Ray Bradbury. It was the top corporate techno innovators on the planet. And he wasn't, this Israeli general wasn't surrounded by the Mediterranean in, like, right by Gaza and some military installation. He was in West Texas, and he was speaking to U.S. corporate and border enforcement leaders about how his country has exploited an open-air prison laboratory, which is Gaza, to modify and to perfect their latest border control and population control and military gadgets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always fun when they talk about experimenting and this kind of thing. You get it. It reminds me of THX 1138, where they're torturing Robert Duvall, but on this side of the glass, they're having this very normal kind of conversation about, well, turn the dial. No, you got it up a little too high there, buddy. Like, you know, where they're just playing with us like we're Gitmo inmates, you know?
And there really is a lot of truth there in terms, I mean, I'm at the U of A right now, University of Arizona, and there is a detachment between your scientific, talented engineers and leaders and scientists and the human consequences of their work. And this detachment is, it's all sorts. It's moral, it's social, like you were saying. You know, on one end, there's this plated glass that could be the metaphor for outside the walls of the classroom, where the police, where military is actually using their scientific applications and massacring people.
Oh, man. So, now, you talk in here about the drones and the money and how Obama gave this big announcement. And as you mentioned here, all the press attention got soaked up in the amnesty or not and how many people are going to be allowed to stay versus being deported. But then so everyone ended up overlooking just how much bipartisanship was going into this border police state here.
And that's also really been lost in the whole discussion, because what what's really been taking the headlines and the so-called controversy is these narrow...
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know what? I'm terrible at watching the clock, and we started late, and I screwed up. We got to go out to this break, but when we get back, we'll be back with Gabriel Chavone about the new Israeli border between Texas, Arizona, and Mexico.
Okay. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Gabriel M. Chavone. And he wrote this piece for Tom Dispatch, co-authored it with Todd Miller. It's at tomdispatch.com and running today at antiwar.com. Gaza in Arizona. Oh, man. Well, if I believed in collectivism and collective punishment, like the Israelis and the American government do, then I would say that we deserve this. But I don't believe in that. It's, of course, innocent people, not those who support it, who will be the victims. Who already are the victims, so that's the way that goes. So if you could please, Gabriel, give us a little bit of a picture of what kind of changes we're really talking about, because they've been building fences and they've been expanding the funding and buying more trucks and hiring more federal cops down there on the border since quite a few years ago now, right?
Yeah, this is just a double expansion of the already unprecedented immigration enforcement apparatus. So think of it as a balloon, just more and more and more expanding, and what's going to happen? And the human consequences of it are catastrophic, and victims in the thousands, and especially those who bear the brunt, are undocumented migrants who are crossing the desert and dying in huge numbers. And then those who are faced regular abuse and mistreatment in especially Border Patrol short-term custody and disappear in ICE prisons. And that's their word, the word disappear, which we can remember from the dirty wars and terrorist wars in Central America that the United States was funding in the 80s and 70s and before.
Oh, man, that's just amazing that they would, I guess, you know, out of the mouths of babes kind of thing, right, where they don't know the connotation. They're just being honest.
Especially if you, some of the people we quote in the article, they're very enthusiastic because they see this as a very exciting time for them, the sort of corporate university intellectuals. They feel like they have the answer to a border problem. And then there's profit to be made, so they're very excited. When I talk with them, you can see it in the twinkle in their eye, and they're very bubbly. Contrasted with when you talk with Border Patrol, for example, they'll talk in a very militaristic, calculated way of speaking. You know, neutralizing a threat, and battlefield type discussion, but. Contrasted with that and corporate types and their suits and scientists in their labs, they talk very, very coolly, very excitedly about these prospects.
Right. Yeah, people really need to understand how that works, where, you know, when an expert comes to tell a bunch of meathead cops about here's the reality of how the Muslims are, or here's what you need to know about our war with illegal immigration, they're basically filling empty vessels here. And you know, even if they make straight A's in that, it's still, that's all they know if they even get that right. And it can be very, very thin bases for the kind of things. Like you're saying, just using the militarist terminology, about, you know, enemies here and sectors to patrol there and this kind of thing escalates what is a civilian law enforcement matter at worst, really, into a virtual war zone.
Mm-hmm. And the responsibility really lies with us, with taxpayers and these intellectuals that, as you say, are filling empty vessels. I mean, at, you know, at the end of the day, border and military soldiers, they're following orders. But the ones who are designing policy and the ones who are helping design those policy are intellectuals and corporate innovators and the civilian chain of command. And that's where social organizing can have a great impact. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you mentioned a Lockheed armored personnel carrier there. So, man, basically there goes the store right there. We know they got their lobbyists and state legislators are no match for them in a million years. But what are you mentioned the intellectuals, the universities and the researchers. And can you tell us some more of the companies and describe a little bit more of the vested interests who are so excited about this?
Sure. Well, I'll stick to Tucson in southern Arizona. That's where this partnership is really crystallized here, and it's a triangular partnership. Think of it as here's the point in southern Arizona, and the sides of it come from Israel, and southern Arizona, and Mexico. And the headquarters are right here in Tucson. The way that they described it to me, and they call it global advantage, is taking the best prospects, economic prospects of Mexican low-wage labor to manufacture the high-tech policing goods provided by Israeli companies that are lured to southern Arizona to set up offices and build this metaphorical and literal boundary-building complex here in southern Arizona. And the way that they do it is taking the regional strength that southern Arizona and the technology clusters have to offer here that no other tech parks in the country and North America have to offer, because they have something unique here, and in many ways they're right, because they're in the belly of the beast, you can say, here in southern Arizona, where it's long been the focus of federal government state resources to expand this border security enforcement ballooning apparatus. They're right here, and that's why they're very excited. And they bring the best of their university intellectual resources.
Man, isn't that just a tragedy that they've got Mexican employees making all the technology of their enslavement? Mm. That's just sad. It's like Palestinians who are reduced to having to work building the Israeli settlements on the West Bank because it's the only way they can feed their family and make it through the week to fight another day.
Exactly. And many of them are referred to as Mexicans in the occupied territory because lots of the industrial lingo is exported from what was experimented on migrants who worked in California, and I'm specifically talking about the date pruning industry and the method of manual pruning of date trees was done by Mexican migrant workers. They perfected it, and then that kind of industry language of date pruning came to be brought along that short-term name, which is Mexican. So you'll see like cab drivers, migrant workers, and others who are Palestinian being referred to as Mexicans in the settlement.
Ain't that fitting? Yeah, areas. Where Americans have a birthright to live and they don't. It's just incredible. I'm sorry we can't keep going. We're all out of time here, and I got you on late and everything. But thank you so much for your time today, Gabriel.
Thank you.
All right, that's Gabriel M. Schiavone. He's at TomDispatch.com and Electronic Intifada.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. So, sorry for the confusion. I screwed up, and I did not have Omar Khadr's lawyer on. I had Gabriel Chavon on to talk about the Israeli border in Arizona. The occupied West Bank, i.e. the West. All right. On the phone is our good friend Adam Morrow. Live from Cairo, reporter for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net when he's writing anyway. But anyway, welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Adam?
Good, Scott. I'm good. Glad to be back.
Good, good. Very happy to talk to you again. Hang on. Let me get my earphones on. I forgot. All right. So how's the Arab Spring going?
Well, I don't know if your listeners saw it yesterday, but there was considerable bloodshed in Egypt as Egyptians marked the fourth anniversary of the January 25th, 2011 uprising that ended the 30-year rule of Hosni Mubarak. We saw demonstrations and clashes across the country yesterday, and I think the final death toll is something like 21 people, and that might include two or three police as well. As usual, it's impossible to really get details because you have the government statements are entirely untrustworthy, and it's just very difficult to get to the bottom of these things. But what we do know, there were definitely violent clashes in several parts of the country yesterday, to many people, to the surprise of many observers, because people had sort of thought that maybe due to a string of recent setbacks, the whole opposition demonstration phase had sort of ended, and these weekly demonstrations were winding down. But yesterday actually looked like things have sort of been re-energized, possibly because of I don't know if you know that Hosni Mubarak, the president, was finally sort of declared innocent of all charges against him, and his two sons, who were also faced charges of corruption, were both let free today. Were both released from prison today.
Today, so all of these things,
yeah,
sorry,
yeah,
just they want to make sure okay. Rub it in your face a little bit there, huh?
Yeah, well, they often do that. They sort of tend to choose these politically significant dates to do these things on. And I think that's the exact intention. I think it's sort of to rub people's faces in it, and you know, the resistance is futile, sort of mindset. Mm-hmm. But yesterday was surprising. Yesterday was again, people didn't expect it was going to be that serious, and it turned out to be a pretty big deal, reflecting massive discontent, I would say, because we're now in a situation basically now where it's a very similar situation to that which preceded the uprising in 2011, where you've got mass unemployment, you've got poverty rates that are above 50% now nationwide, the very little chance for any sort of upward mobility on the part of, you know, the thousands of fresh graduates that enter the job market every year. So the situation is no better. The desperation is the same. The economic stagnation is the same. People don't see any change, you know, 4 years after the uprising and a full year and a half now since the coup that replaced the elected president, Mohamed Morsi, with its current president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. So people haven't seen anything, any improvements, and yeah, there's still a lot of resentment, as was palpable yesterday.
Mm. All right, well, so I think first question is, who all's protesting out there? Are they mostly Muslim Brotherhood supporters, or is it, I know the big headline here was the young woman from the Socialist Party who was killed, murdered.
by government forces with birdshot from a shotgun killed her. But
yeah, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. And while it's tragic what happened to her, of course, needless to say, I mean, everybody is in unanimous on the tragedy of that incident. What's interesting also is how there's definitely a trend in the media to sort of seize on the non-Islamist victims of these recent political violence. Yes, you know, I mean, she was apparently a socialist, but she was atypical
the pictures of her death went out on Twitter almost immediately, I think, and so
they caught her death on camera, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, no, grotesque, definitely grotesque. You know, the police are heavy-handed as ever. I mean, they're basically, they begin with live ammunition. It's not like in the past where they would start with tear gas and then move up to birdshot. They start with the heavy ammo right off the bat. You know, that's how desperate they are to clamp down on these protests. But back to your question about who's protesting, right. It's a very good question, and it's interesting how little what we had traditionally called the revolutionary. The revolutionaries are participating in the demonstrations we've seen over the last year and a half, and they have become, for the most part, they have definitely become brotherhood led. That's not to say that you have leftists in there and you have some liberal activists and these sort of things that have joined in as well. But for the most part, the bulk of it is definitely being led and being maintained by people who are demanding the reinstatement of Morsi as president. Which is interesting because if you remember the sort of long interregnum between Mubarak and Morsi, there was a very strong revolutionary presence all the time. There were constant revolutionary demonstrations for every possible thing you could conceive of. These so-called revolutionary forces were calling demonstrations both before Morsi was elected and after he was elected. They continued to push these demonstrations all the time. And what's interesting now is how little you hear of these so-called revolutionary groups now.
I mean, it sounds like what happened was they got their coup. The military came and kicked the Muslim Brotherhood out of power. And then that was when they quit protesting because that was what they really wanted. They were happier with the next Mubarak in line than with the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, from what I understand, the revolutionary camp was split in two after that. You basically had the ones who were like, look, you know, this is the best thing for everybody. Democracy, if democracy leads to Islamism, then let the military take over. And then you had another camp who will always be against the military establishment and who will always be against the Mubarak regime. And that was what was reanimated. I mean, the coup brought back the Mubarak regime. So those people, you know, you have those people who are against the Brotherhood and who are also against who are against any sort of return to the Mubarak regime. Yeah. But it's just interesting how little organization you're seeing. I mean, it's the Brotherhood has been the only one that's been able to consistently, despite the incredible crackdown, despite this unbelievable, unprecedented crackdown on the Brotherhood. I mean, people are saying it's by far the worst crackdown going back to the Nasser period, that this is the Brotherhood has said this is the worst thing by far that we've ever faced. But yet they've still managed to mobilize people on the streets, which is pretty remarkable. And they're doing it from exile for the most part. A lot of them are in Qatar. A lot of them are in Turkey now. But again, there's no revolutionary front, you know, there's no single sort of revolutionary party or front that you could really name that's been particularly active in the demonstrations. So back to your question, who is demonstrating? It's interesting now, a full 4 years after January 25th, and if you remember, some of the early criticisms of the Brotherhood was that it sort of waited a little bit before it joined the revolution in 2011. It sort of tested the waters to make sure that, you know, is this thing really going to take off, or are we going to throw in our lot with this thing and then get screwed in the end, you know, because it turns out to be a dud or whatever. So they took some criticism early on, saying that, oh, you know, they didn't participate in the revolution from the first day. It took them a couple days before they joined. And what's interesting is we've gone from that to now, where they pretty much, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of people would take exception to this, but from what I can see, they really are the main revolutionary force.
Mm-hmm. And it's part of that is just a generational thing, right? Where all the old men are in jail, so the young Muslim Brotherhood guys, they don't have to be conservative. They can be, you know, on the right, but radical rather than conservative.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of the young guys are in prison, too. I mean, the numbers that we're hearing range from 20,000 to 40,000 people behind bars.
Really? 20,000 to 40,000 Wow.
Yeah.
And how many killed? I know there were more than 1,000 massacred right during the coup, but then what about since then? Do you know?
I don't have a tally. I mean, since the coup, which was July 3rd of 2013, so that's about a year and a half ago.
Real quick. All right, hold it. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Sure.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back. I got Adam Morrow on the line. Reporting for us from Cairo. And I'm sorry, man, about these hard breaks, Adam, and I never look at the clock.
No worries.
So the question was, I know approximately 1,000 people were killed right during the coup d'etat in the summer of 2013, and I know that hundreds more have been sentenced to death for, you know, treason or whatever, all convicted and sentenced in unison by hundreds at a time, like a Mooney wedding or something. But so then that was all the preface to the question of how many people do you think have been killed since then, if there's any kind of reasonable way to estimate?
Since July 3rd, and I'm sure tallies have been done. I mean, people are tracking this. You know, you'll have, for example, 20 people were killed yesterday. If the January 25th that preceded it, I think it was 60 people were killed. That was 1 year ago. So all of these things have probably added up. And well, also, by the way, the numbers of the people who were killed on August 14th, which was when those two big pro-Morsi sit-ins were dispersed, were violently dispersed by security forces. It's still uncertain exactly how many people were killed. I mean, the death tolls are conflict wildly. You know, the government has consistently come out and said it was no more than 500 or something like that. The Brotherhood has said something like 2,500. So people are, the consensus is sort of like it's about 1,000, maybe a bit more than 1,000 on August 14th alone of 2013. So it's really hard to nail down. What we can definitely say that at least 2,000 people, or maybe even as much as 2,500, have definitely been confirmed killed. And that's a conservative estimate. And that's not including all the people that were killed after the 2011 uprising. If you remember, in 2011, something like 800 people were killed during the 18-day uprising, and none of those. None of the killers of those people have been brought to account. As I mentioned earlier, Mubarak and his long-standing interior minister, Habib al-Adli, and a bunch of ministry officials, and Mubarak's two sons, all of those guys have been vindicated or exonerated of murder charges. So as it currently stands, I mean, nobody's paid any price for any of the people that were killed, even back in 2011 at this point. And this is, by the way, one of the things that's contributing to popular discontent is this sense of unaccountability and the fact that so many people have died and virtually no one has been held account for. The only people that are going to jail are demonstrators at this point.
Well, and this just in from antiwar.com is the Egyptian health ministry is saying that the death toll is 23 from yesterday, and while the Muslim Brotherhood or the pro-Morsi bloc, as they call it here in this GCReport.com, they're saying 25. But yeah, so that was going to be what I was going to ask you, too, was about the popular perception of Morsi, who, you know, deposed the barely popularly elected Muslim Brotherhood that obviously was the subject of much discontent. But if there was a way you could compare him to, say, Mubarak's popularity, you know, I don't know, 6 months before the Arab Spring broke out or something like that.
Sure. You mentioned Morsi. Did you mean Sisi?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, I did. I meant Field Marshal, meaning Desk Officer Sisi, who's never been in a fight in his life and is now the Israeli and American and self-appointed dictator of Egypt, Chancellor of the Revolution of 2011, the villain Sisi. Yes.
Right. Well, as we've mentioned before, he went from a sort of high. That was very much media induced, by the way. This sort of euphoria that followed Morsi's ouster and this, you know, the ascension of this great new national savior, Sisi, was very much media, you know, this was entirely born of media hype. I mean, the media was behind this guy like, people were comparing him to Old Testament prophets, and I mean, it was just like, it's completely out of control. So that sort of initial euphoria has fell very, very quickly. And now a full year and a half since he took over, I would say it's kind of bottomed out. And a lot of the people who had sort of fallen for the trick, who had sort of supported him in those early days and who had joined those anti-Morsi protests in the summer of 2013, a lot of those people have now sort of changed their minds, and a lot of them express, feel that they've been tricked, basically, feel that they were duped. And they were like, we thought this guy was going to come in and clean house and change things overnight and da-da-da-da, and it's been a full year and a half now, full of more than 6 months since he's been president now, and we've seen, you know, and there are very few tangible results on the street. There's no changes in the standard of living or anything like that that the average person can point to. You know, he's tried some. There are media bids to improve his legitimacy, to improve his popular legitimacy, like this big Suez Canal project, which it was claimed was gonna accrue all this fresh revenue to Egypt. But of course, none of that hasn't been completed yet. And so people aren't happy. And I think there's some people are saying that you might see another big explosion on June 30th, which would basically mark the second anniversary of the coup. So, like I said earlier, you wanted to compare it to Mubarak. Even though Sisi's only been around, we've only even known Sisi's name for the last 2 years, he finds himself now in a very similar position as Mubarak, where he's dealing with deep discontent countrywide.
You can't take 2011 back. The people of Egypt have proven how much power they have when they can get their act together, and that's a lesson that they're not ever going to be able to forget. You know, they did
right.
it to, so they don't, in other words, it took them 30 years to realize they could get rid of this Mubarak guy, but now they're fresh from getting that done, even if it is 4 years later. That's not very long. So he's in a different position than Mubarak was, it seems like.
It's easier for them to imagine
hurting him or getting rid of him.
Exactly. The people know that they did it once so that it can be done. And at the same time, the regime knows it also, so they're incredibly defensive and about criticism. You know, they're extremely defensive.
Hey, let me ask you this:
and insecure.
To give the devil his due here, is he really trying to be a good technocrat and get everything together as best he can, or is this guy just simply another African kleptocrat?
Oh, I think, I mean, any attempt to make the country function better and to improve the lot of the average Egyptian, I think is done for entirely tactical purposes, and, you know, would only be to forestall revolution. I don't think it's out of any genuine desire, to help the average citizen, you know, any steps taken in that direction would only be in order to ease public disaffection with his regime. I don't think it would be out of any true sense of empathy with the average Egyptian.
Now, so the Muslim Brotherhood is outlawed, but are there any kind of parliamentary elections coming up? Any other real players, or it'll just be a
joke? There are parliamentary elections coming up, but everybody sort of knows that they're completely valueless because they don't, it'll be an entirely cardboard, rubber stamp assembly. You know, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood were the real opposition before 2011. They were the real opposition. And all the other parties were just basically there to provide the illusion of multi-party democracy. The Brotherhood represented the only real opposition. The only opposition that wasn't made up just to lend the regime legitimacy. Now that they're gone, the only ones left you have are these, you know, these ones that are willing to just be for show. They're just show parties. So it's kind of a waste. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of badly needed Egyptian resources. You know, the country's already struggling, and they're going to have to, what are they going to, are they going to spend several million Egyptian pounds putting on elections that don't really have any practical, you know, there's no practical necessity. So you have that. There's a lot of cynicism in that regard. I mean, why? What's the point? We've got a dictator. Everybody knows. Why do we need to spend all this time and aggravation? And I'm sure the regime thinks the same thing. You know, I'm sure they're thinking, like, good grief, I can't believe we have to go through this stupid, we have to put on this stupid show for everybody. You know, they would much rather do without it. You know, they have to maintain the impression.
All right, now give me a minute here real quick on Rafah. Is it true that they're just completely razing the village of Rafah, creating a no-man land?
Yeah.
Tell me, quick.
From what I understood, they doubled this buffer zone from a 500-meter buffer zone to a full kilometer buffer zone, which runs along the border between Egypt Sinai Peninsula and
So this
and
just
Gaza
completely
Strip.
Destroys the black market tunnels? Is that it? This just eliminates them, Adam?
I mean, that's their aim. I don't know how many of these tunnels are still in operation, but I'm assuming that most of them are gone, if not all of them at this point.
All right. Thank you so much for coming back on my show, man. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Adam Morrow from Cairo. Be safe out there, dude. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening. ScottHorton.org.